Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer recruiting experts. Now, here's your host, Chris Cousins.
Hi, everyone. Chris Cousins from Sports Recruiting USA here. It's a slightly different episode than normal. Usually we have a guest on and we talk about the life and stuff like that, but this time it's a special. I use the word special loosely, but it's a coronavirus special to kind of bring everyone up to speed about what's going on in the college soccer world with this whole COVID-19 coronavirus situation. So yeah, we brought together some of our experienced staff. As you'll hear on the podcast, everyone's kind of working from home at the minute, self-isolating or whatever you want to call it, but you hear a few dogs and a few cuckoo clocks and stuff like that, so that's why it's not great audio in some places. But yeah, we brought together, we've got James Dawes, who's my right-hand man in the UK office. He kind of leads the podcast because unfortunately I couldn't make it. We've got Don Williams, who's the head of operations in North America, and you've got Ernie Yarborough, Matt Minnell, and Mike Avery, all on staff, all former college coaches, and even national champions in that as well. So some of the most experienced college coaches over the last 20-30 years in this little mix that we've got of a podcast. So yeah, it's for coaches, it's for players, it's for whoever wants to listen to it. But we thought we'd put together some of these college soccer experienced brains and just kind of run through it all. And there's some good points made, to be fair, about for players, about programs, about schools, for coaches, everything really. So if you're any of them, if you're a parent, if you're a player, like I say, if you're a coach, whatever, it's definitely worth a listen. So that's less of me talking, but get right into it. And this is the Inside College Soccer Podcast, the coronavirus special.
So hi guys, James Dawes here from Sports Recruiting USA, and welcome to another episode of Inside the College Soccer Podcast. I'll be filling in as host today in Chris's absence, but joining me we have Don Williams, Ernie Yarborough, Mathis Minnell and Mike Avery. Guys, how are we all doing?
Great.
Doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great stuff. I think the aim of today, guys, is really just to shed some light, give some guidance, advice and opinion on the future of college soccer really moving forward, obviously with the highly publicised outbreak of the coronavirus, which has caused, cancellation of spring seasons and youth tournaments across America and the rest of the world. So Don, I'll kind of come to you first. Do you want to start by recalling, the timeline since this all broke out and how it's affected recruiting moving forward?
Well, I can tell you that for myself, we heard it, we heard about this whole thing about six, eight weeks ago going on overseas. And even in the beginning of February, we were kind of wondering how serious this all was going to be. And boy, has it hit hard. As you guys know, last Friday, ironically, Friday the 13th, the NCAA came up with a recruiting update. They officially announced a dead period for all in-person recruiting. And at this point, it's at least through April 15th. And this is, in light of concern of the virus. So from what we know at this point, most colleges have been shut down. Spring sports have been canceled. Recruiting visits have been severely hampered. Right now, all coaches can do is phone calls, emails, video calls, text messages, and they're not allowed to have any official on-campus visits, no off-campus recruiting, no in-person contact, no evaluations, participation in camps and clinics. It's shut down. So, yeah, what do you guys think? I mean, it's crazy, huh?
Yeah. So, obviously, you guys. It's interesting because I'm coming at this from a massive. I'm a former player. Very recently, only about 2 years ago, that I was back playing. So it's very interesting to get you guys, coaches, former coaches' perspective on this. So, Ernie, how does the coaches' approach change now moving forward in terms of recruitment, in terms of planning for, next fall and moving forward?
I think one of the first things that a lot of coaches are doing right now is evaluating where they are with their rosters, and dealing with their internal operations within their athletic departments, because one of the things that's been affected by all of this is the additional year of eligibility for some athletes in certain sports that won't be participating this spring. And a former colleague of mine at one of the universities I worked with actually laid out a timeline for her sport that really shows this affecting athletic budgets for the next, you know, 4 to 5 years, basically, until you kind of wash this class out that's going to get an extra year. So I think the first step for a lot of coaches has been to kind of take stock of where they are and what they are able to do. Once that has happened, and this has occurred in the last few days, a few of them have already reached out to me with regards to what we do. But now they have to look in a different direction to A, locate and evaluate prospects, and B, kind of take stock in how they get information about those players, whether it be video, whether it be recommendations, whether it be contacts that they use person to person, as opposed to maybe having someone come onto campus. And so I think there's going to be a big area of need for coaches to reach out to trusted sources, whether that be a club coach, a recruiting service, former colleagues that may be out working now, looking at kids, to kind of open up the class for 2021, and then to find any immediate needs for the remaining 2020 class. It's going to be reliance on kids having good video, maybe playing in certain environments where there's coaches with more reputable reputations who have placed players. I think a coach's reputation for having done a good job in getting kids into the right environments with the right coaches who have had some success is going to pay dividends. You know, we talk a lot about in the college coaching circles about having trusted confidants, trusted sources, trusted people we work with. I think that's going to be true now more than ever moving forward.
Mike, what do you think? Because your wife does. Your wife's also a college volleyball coach, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So what's the discussion in the Avery household? And what's your perspective, you know, having coached it at Notre Dame and, you know, having coached at Valparaiso and, you know, been involved in a while, what's she saying? What's being said in the household?
Yeah, I think very much what Ernie just talked about, but there's just so many unknowns, and I think coaches are wired in such a way where you're always wanting to be working. You're always wanting to be recruiting. So everybody's got to take a pause a little bit and catch their breath. But I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out, how am I going to channel my energy? How can I be prepared so that when things ease back up, I can still hit the ground running? And so there's a lot of video. There's a lot of conversations on the phone and text messages and Skype calls and just a lot of activity of trying to stay connected to the player pool for her in volleyball. And then, you know, for us in soccer as well.
Yeah, I want to hear, maybe we'll circle back to it. I do want to hear, Mike, how you think this is going to affect the pro game, since you're now involved in the men's pro game.
Yeah, for sure.
What do you think? What do you see happening, Matt, with the timeline? How do you see this affecting the timeline? Do you see it slowing things down for college coaches or what?
Yeah. I think that's one that it's probably going to be unique to probably to the school, but I think that there's some schools that have been done with their class for a stretch, right? And that they're going to be fine. Now, the schools that tend to take a lot of transfer students or, you know, graduated players at the semester break that are going on to a pro environment, those are the schools that are, and that always has a trickle-down effect. What happens at one school then maybe affects what happens at another place. I think that the hard part about it is if, whether by design or whether by chance, colleges have roster spots to flesh out and have recruiting needs to meet, especially as, you know, and obviously application deadlines are going to come into play, but this is going to be something that certainly takes what is kind of a stressful endeavor anyway, but it's really going to kind of compact everyone's timeline. And I think that the hard part is going to be for not only the prospective student athlete, but for the coach, is that, you know, we always talk about the right fit and getting a player into a place where he or she feels the most comfortable and is going to have the best experience and is going to be the right fit of school. With the timelines being, you know, just compacted, the decision-making tree is going to be really important to make sure that you have good counsel on both sides of the equation, because this is a situation that screams, hey, make a decision really fast. And as we know, when that happens, that's usually never a good thing.
You know, just going over one of the issues Mathis had talked about was the roster opportunities for some schools having available space later in their class. You know, a lot of the bigger programs, especially on the women's side, are going to be wrapped up early. But several programs leave a spot open for a transfer, a late add, maybe an international type that comes to them through their contacts and sources. And one of the things that goes with those spots is having available aid. And I always said that any coach probably has at least half a scholarship available. And if they don't use it on a transfer or a late addition, they're able to rework it into their team roster at that time. And so one of the things I think that having good contacts on both sides, as Mathis talked about, was basically knowing how that money is going to be affected by the budgets that are going to be affected by having additional years for spring athletes. You know, you're talking about potentially millions of dollars in aid that have to come from somewhere. And so if a coach has, at this point right now, has, you know, $50,000 available in their budget, does that mean that they're going to get to use it, or is the school going to come and take it to reallocate amongst other sports out of need? And so having the ability and trust in coaches that we have, or that you know, to get that information and be able to use it is going to be very important, because there's no guarantee that just because the money's there that a coach is going to be able to use it moving forward.
And Ernie, you mentioned there about you know, having money available for transfer kids coming into programs, right? So how does that look in terms of, you know, transfer or guys that are at junior colleges or looking to transfer this year? They've had their spring seasons cancelled, so a lot of them haven't had the, you know, the opportunity to play in front of the, you know, the D1 schools in the spring season games, or, you know, other schools, and that's a massive part of the recruitment process, surely, in terms of, you know, the transfer process. So guys, how do you see that working for guys that are at junior colleges now, trying to make that next step? What can they be doing to, you know, maybe secure a move to some of these schools in you know, the event that their spring seasons have just been cancelled?
I mean, I'll go back to it. I think a big step for them is going to be, again, as I mentioned in the first part, having good connections, whether it's their junior college coach, having the connections needed, whether it's a former club coach that they've played with, maybe it's a player that they've played with at their school who's at another school now, that they can get in touch with coaches. I mean, I know when I was at Marion, that happened with a couple of players from junior colleges where, you know, hey coach, I got this kid who's wanting to come, and, you know, I look into things and move forward accordingly. And so again, I think it's going to be a lot of opportunity for, you know, whether it's services, whether it's coaches, whether it's former colleagues and contacts, these kids really have to use whatever availability they have within their network to get their name, their video, their information out to as many opportunity schools as possible.
Mm-hmm. And Don, I was reading the other day, I came across it on social media, that, you know, coaches leave it until the spring season to make the decision upon players whether, you know, they're going to reward them more scholarship next year, or whether they're going to look to bring someone in that position. So players are really fighting for places during this period. Do you see that in the event that all this is happening, how do you see that affecting, you know, guys that are in programs already that maybe were fighting for extra scholarship money? Is there any way that, you know, that how a coach is going to approach that issue now?
Yeah, it's interesting, because while it's true, I mean, we a lot of times we use that spring as an evaluative process to let players play. Maybe they didn't get a lot of chance to play in the fall, and to see how they interact with that challenge and that, or that monkey on their back, you know? And but now I'm not sure that it necessarily changes a whole lot, because the last evaluative pieces of the new players coming in has been slowed down, hasn't it? So there's going possibly less competition coming in for those spots. I don't know. What do you think, Matt?
I mean, this is where it gets kind of tricky, right? And this is, and the hard part about this whole thing is that it, everything, all that stuff can happen at once. I think the part that is, for me, if I put on my coaching hat, I'm like, if I had left it late, now the hard part is one, am I going to have the money? And all depending on the health of your athletic department and, you know, how good your baseball team and softball team are and every school will be different how they do it. But then in terms of, you know, you've got transfers, you've got JC, you've got four-year kids. Then you've got the international piece where, you know, these are kids that are really waiting maybe to the end to whether or not they're going to get pro deals or whether or not, you know, college in the United States is the route to go. But then if I'm a college coach and I'm looking at this, this is hard because now then I may have to commit this money to a player that I'm not really sure about, or they're not really sure about us. And then you talk about transfer stuff, and then we start getting into the APR. So for me, this literally, and we've talked about this, you know, offline, is that to have that trusted resource and to be able to, you know, like Ernie said, someone I can trust and someone whose opinion that I value. But then also too, you know, when you talk about kids coming from an organization, knowing that the organization is not just signing whoever, but they're trying to get players that have the ability and trying to get them to that right fit. I mean, I literally look at this, and just from the soccer perspective, I look at the coaches that are having to manage this, and I have no envy to them whatsoever. This is really such a surreal and strange time, and it would be hard. And as a parent of a kid who's a player who's starting to enter into that college recruitment process, if I was a parent dealing with this now, man, I would be over the moon stressed out.
Yeah. Mike, we're kind of talking about how it affects the 2020s, but let's talk about maybe how it might affect the 2021 class. Of course, it's a little speculation here we're going on, because is this going to go on? Frankly, I think it's going to go well past the April 15th deadline that everybody seems to be putting on it. If you look at what's going on in China, it took, you know, nearly, you know, 4 months to burn itself out. It seems to be slowing down a little bit from what I hear. But so, geez, you know, tack another 2-3 months onto this, and we're missing some of the main 2021 recruiting season, considering that the national signing day was moved up to November, right? So what do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, it's all speculative right now, but you know, I think coaches are going to worry about the most important thing first, which is the team that they have on campus or had on campus most recently and what happens in the fall. And I think that's going to take up a lot of their time. And then I think then you're going to start thinking about the next group in the 2021s. And in some cases, the 2022s, if you're coaching on the women's side. And so, you know, I think everybody, you know, my best advice to everybody, coaches and the recruits, is I would be as organized as I can be, and so I'm as agile as I can be, so that when any opportunity comes up, I can jump, whether that's in me recruiting a player or a player looking for a school. I think you have to have all your ducks in a row as much as you can, as much information compiled as you can, and be ready to roll when you need to, because those people that are able to move quickly are the ones that are gonna start winning as soon as this thing opens back up again.
And Matt, just on that point, do you expect to see changes next year in terms of the teams that are competing at the top, you know, for national titles, or do you think those teams will remain at the top? Is it anybody's game at the minute? What do you see the future being?
Yeah, you know, I guess it's hard to say. I mean, I think the teams that are at the top are at the top for a long time and probably will be there again for a reason, you know. And I think they're typically ones whose rosters don't have as much shifting going on You know, they're not sending a couple of guys off at the end and taking a couple of last minute players in. They have more stability in their rosters. Again, you know, there's so many unknowns that we don't know about. What if you have an international player that had been home for spring break and can't get back? You know what I mean? There's all of these factors that we just don't really know what it's going to look like. You know, you're counting on incoming players. What if the clearinghouse gets slowed down? You know, all of these things they might have an answer to from the NCAA standpoint, but even in the best of times, it's sometimes slow. So what happens now? It's the wild, wild west in many ways. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Absolutely.
Mike, jumping in on that point, but there's a whole nother level. And you talk about the top programs, and we see this more and more as top programs are committing kids, especially from MLS academies. Right. And then all of a sudden those kids to sign a homegrown. Well, the hard part is now that the professional game is on hold and they're waiting, especially in this country, those kids, you know, that you had kind of allotted for, but then kind of had not allotted for, because you think, oh, well, they're with the LA Galaxy and we think they're going to sign a pro deal. We've got a spot for them, but we're not really. That's a whole nother level of player that then may say, hey, where the parent club's like, listen, we don't either have the training room or we don't have the funds or it's not great for your development cycle. Go to college and get some games in because we're not going to be able to fit you in because of the compacted nature of what the MLS schedule is. And that's a whole nother wrinkle. And when that starts to happen, we talk about the finances part. That throws everything into whack. And Ernie touched on, you know, they're holding maybe half or a full scholarship in reserve for that. All of a sudden, their ability to be nimble, like Mike talked about, gets completely thrown out the window. So, I mean, this literally has so many factors in the game, from the student athlete coming in to the student athlete who thinks he's going to be a pro. Well, maybe now he's not going to be a pro. He has to go to college. And this is it could be really, really challenging. And especially then when you talk about the clearinghouse clearing kids, it's going to be really tough.
Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
Well, one issue, and I think I believe it was Mike mentioned this, with kids going back on spring break and potentially not being able to get back in the country, and that could be American kids or foreign kids at this point. But the reality, too, is what impact is this going to have on a foreign recruitment cycle? You know, depending on countries, depending on, you know, limitations, depending on timing, depending on the clearinghouse, all those types of things. So I just think, again, as Mike said, having a coach or a program, if you will, that has as many of their ducks in a row as possible are the ones that are going to get the biggest advantage, because they're going to be ready to go with as many available options as possible when this starts to open back up.
Mm-hmm. And James, you're starting to see some issues already being in the UK and bringing kids over from not just the UK, but from overseas. We've got some SAT issues, don't we?
We do, yeah. And again, we're going into uncharted territory, so it's hard to say how they're going to get around this, really. I mean, the NCAA, like we said, that at the best of times, you know, it takes time for guys to get through the clearinghouse. So without, you know, SAT scores and things like that, the only way we can see, you know, getting around it is by offering, you know, waivers and sort of treating this year as a, how do you say it really, kind of letting the guys go through who haven't, you know, gone through already without the SAT, let's say. Obviously, junior college is going to be a route as well if that's not the case. Again, you kind of take it on a weekly basis at the moment, if not a day-by-day basis, because it's evolving every day. And I mean, I'd be interested to get your guys' point. Without the SAT, guys, in terms of funding for academic purposes, you know, getting accepted into the school, can you see it going any other way other than, you know, letting guys, you know, maybe a pass this year or giving guys a waiver? What do you guys think?
Let's recap real quick, just for those that might be listening that may not be aware of how this works. The NCAA requires the SAT or the ACT, in which a score is equivalent on a sliding scale. So in other words, the higher your GPA, the lower your score can be to be NCAA eligible. Now that doesn't mean you're getting into that school. Certain schools have a, you know, a 1400 SAT minimum requirement with a 4.0 GPA just to get into the school. But it doesn't mean the school is going to allow you in, but it does mean that you would be NCAA eligible if you meet grade and SAT requirements and or ACT. And the NAIA, on the other hand, it's different. Now, Ernie, you just having come out of the NAIA, I believe, your last school, right? But why don't you kind of explain to everybody how that works with the NCAA, how they can get around not taking the SAT or the ACT?
Well, one of the things that the NAIA did last year, because they revamped their clearinghouse protocol, was they allowed schools to quote unquote vouch for the student athlete. And so, and we actually did that for one young man whose transcript hadn't been cleared in time for the fall season. And so basically what it meant was the school kind of put their, you know, compliance officer, if you want to call it that, or person in charge of the relationship with the NAIA national office, basically took responsibility and the penalty option if it came to pass that person wasn't going to get qualified. And so arguably you basically did your own homework. You knew what their GPA base was. You knew what their test score base was. You knew what their class rank base was. And you kind of said, hey, even though you guys haven't done it yet, we can tell you that this kid's going to pass. And so that was definitely a step away from something the NCAA had ever done. And it worked very easily. I mean, simply put, we were the first program at our school to utilize it. The AD basically signed off after a meeting with you and the academic advisor person that was involved. And so that was a big step different than the NCAA. Outside of that, you know, basically there was always going to be a bottom line score.
How does the 50% rule come into play?
So the price.
That's kind of what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Sorry. That has to do with scholarship aid. So yes, if you can't take an SAT now, how does that affect it? It could be an interesting way to look at it, because the way it works in the NAIA, and this is completely different than the NCAA, is you have your allotment of aid. So in our case, it was, I think it's, you know, 10 scholarships you're allowed. We were a 65% sport, so we lost, you know, 35% in our conference. Our conference only covered 65% maximum of what you were allowed. And so, you know, we were basically a 7.8 limit. And then you multiply that by the cost of attendance, you know, full cost of attendance for your school, and you come up with a number. And so you're allowed that much money to spend on aid. And the way it works in the NAIA is any institutional aid, whether it's academic, housing, or athletic, is considered aid. And so in order to offset some of that cost, if a student athlete coming in has a 3.5 GPA or higher, a certain level of SAT or ACT score or higher, and I believe top 10% or top 20% of their class or higher, and meets any one of those thresholds, they are only half of that money would count against your total number. If they were a 3.75, a higher SAT, higher ACT, and I think top 10% of their class, any one of those three things, then none of their money counted against you. And so you really, you know, finding the high-end academic who was also a good player was definitely on top of your list, because it affected your roster quite a bit and your scholarship aid. The caveat to that is once they're on campus and with any four-year school transfers or junior college transfers coming in and getting that school's GPA, if they have a 3.3, they're 50%, or 3.6, they're zero. And so there's definitely, again, for those junior college kids or those transfer kids to keep their grades at a high level and to keep kids on your roster academically strong, there is definitely a financial incentive for your scholarship budget to make academics a priority.
So if I hear you right, it does sound like if an overseas player can't get to an SAT testing center in time, because the March dates, by the way, have been wiped out right now. We don't know when the next international date is going to be for testing that they're going to be able to hold. The NAIA could be a possibility for that player. Is that correct, Ernie?
I would have to check on that to make sure that they still, that they're going to have a minimum test score standard. Again, each school was put in a position last year to vouch for a student, but they still had to have a test score. And so how that affects that now, I just don't have the answer to that. I can find out very quickly. But again, when it comes to the actual scholarship piece, I would venture to say that the GPA or a class rank can trump a test score situation. You know, the test score is only one of the three prongs that had to be met. And so if you met any one of the three, you could go over those limits and get the scholarship reduction. So, you know, at the end of the day, how this affects what's going to happen at the NSA level, how it's going to affect at the NAI level because the kids can't take the test, that's a different question that I just simply don't have the answer for at this moment, but I can certainly find out rather quickly.
Yeah, and of course, junior college is going to be an option as kids are not qualifiers to go into the NCAA. They've always been able to take the junior college route, get the AA degree. That would make them a qualifier without ever having taken the SAT.
With that being the case, do we expect to see a real rise in the level of JUCO, you know, standard this year? Or do you think more players will look to go down that route? What are we expecting?
What do you think, Matt? You've been around a while. You've looked at a few JC kids in the past. What do you think?
Well, I think the JC kids are. It's going to be awesome. I mean, and again, you know, it's all speculation. This is assuming that the NCAA rules in the favor of sanity and with the student athlete's best interest at heart. There's also the other chance that the NCAA says, okay, you know what, you don't have the SAT score. Okay, you're out, and then you absolutely. The JUCO or the NAI route comes. And I think that probably, you know, like Mike talked about is being nimble, you know, players are going to be nimble because really as, you know, and again, speculation is tough, but you know, I think that the JUCO route, especially given how this is going to go, I think you could see a lot of players do that. And then the wonderful thing about that is if they're a qualifier or if they, then they go to JUCO, they don't have to get the AA degree. They can just go for a year and then be eligible to go to an NCAA school. So if you know you're a decent, you know you're a good student athlete and you know you've got a good profile, you know, the JUCO route may be really good because, yeah, you're going to burn a year of eligibility, but you're going to be able to put good stuff on tape and then go after a year. So, yeah, I think the JUCO ranks, you know, in terms of James asked about could the level go up, I think that you could end up with a really high influx of players to that just because, you know, JUCOs aren't facing the same kind of entry rule. So it could be really good.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify that real quick. Unless it's changed, I still believe that you have to be, in order to not stay there 2 years and get your AA degree, in order to be able to go out after just 1 year, you need to be registered with the NCAA Clearing Center and be a full qualifier going into junior college. Is that everybody's understanding?
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's correct. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so just going back to that, obviously, as a former JUCO player and a college player just in general, me and Don were speaking about this earlier. Obviously, the NCAA was due to vote on, you know, the 10-month season. I think that was coming up in April. Now, you know, over social media, seeing friends have their seasons cut short. College is short enough without, you know, without any of this going on. 4 years goes by really, really quickly. So seeing, you know, friends have their seasons cut short is obviously devastating. But does this bring to light some of the really positive aspects of the spring season in terms of, you know, for players, you know, improvement and development, but also coaches in terms of recruitment? Does this change people's opinions, do you think? Ernie, do you want to comment on that to start, or Mike?
What do you think, Ernie? What do you think?
Go ahead and repeat that again. I had some kids running around in my ear.
So, yeah, I was saying that obviously with everything going on, you know, seeing players have the year cut short, the spring season's cancelled.
Yes.
Does this bring to light all the positive aspects that the spring has in terms of, you know, from the player's point of view, but also you know, coaches when we're talking about recruiting a lot. That's been our main focus today.
Yeah, I mean, the spring discussion around college soccer has been going on forever. You know, one of Mike's mentors, Bobby Clark, used to say it best, you know, the spring is basically a lot of studying because matches are the test. And at one point they were trying to take away spring competition in general. And he and I had a great discussion. He said, how do you evaluate your students if you don't give them any tests? And so when they've lost that now, it's going to be difficult for coaches to evaluate what they have in their own pool right now. I know Mike mentioned earlier, you first have to take care of those kids on campus and in your roster currently. At the same time, you know, what level of development are they going to have? How are they going to compete and fare against what you think you have with an incoming freshman? I think potentially, from a recruit standpoint, there's a great opportunity if you're out taking advantage of any training you can do on your own, any training you can get in a small group, individually with a coach, whatever it may be, to take advantage of potential opportunities within a college roster when you get there. But again, I think the bigger question may be, how important is this preseason going to be? Should we be allowed to have them over here, with the timing of everything? Because you're going to have kids that maybe haven't played in 6 months, 4, 5, 6 months. I think Mike's opportunity, should the NPSL season, or what is it, USL 2 now season come to pass, I think that's going to be a great opportunity for kids to get chances to play, and coaches to evaluate some of their players, because the spring season's being cut out now. And so, you know, that 6 to 8 week period where you had, you know, at the NCAA level, daily training and matches, the NAIA level, again, daily training and matches, and the junior college opportunities to play some of those other levels. And that's the other thing too in the spring schedule that a lot of people may or may not realize, is that's the opportunity for a quote unquote lower division to play a higher division. You know, for an NAIA team to play a Division I team, for a Division II team to play a Division I team, a JUCO team to play anything above them, and for those players to test themselves against the different levels and the different levels of talent within the game. So I think it's going to expose a lot of players. It's going to expose a lot of programs. But at the same time, I think it's going to provide a lot of opportunity for players coming into programs to maybe have a bigger impact than maybe they've ever had before.
That's a nice segue right there. I'd like to hear what Mike, what you have to say, being currently in the program, pro game, how you see maybe this being utilized for coaches to be able to evaluate their players in the summer, maybe in a way that they didn't before. And then after that, Mike, I'd like, Matt, sorry, I'd like to hear what you had to say, having your son in that situation at DC United, you know, needing to be evaluated along with everybody else, and this whole thing slows it down. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the NPSL, the USL 2, that fourth tier of soccer in America could be huge this summer if we have a chance to play that season. You know, right now, I know that in my situation, our ownership or following the directives of the league office, and, you know, it gets pushed back 2 weeks and then pushed back another 2 weeks and pushed back. There's going to come a point in time where, if it gets pushed back too far, they might not be able to play. And then if that happens, will these teams be able to survive? Because the ownership's not set up not to play. These are, you know, smaller markets and smaller budgets, and hopefully they'll be able to survive it. But that's going to be a real interesting challenge for a lot of these programs. At the USL 2 NPSL level. But if it does happen, if in May we're playing soccer, and God hopes that we do, I think we can be a huge step for these kids that are preparing for their college season. Because as Ernie just mentioned, some of them won't have played for a while. And so, you know, you get to go in for a 2.5 week preseason and jump right into a college soccer season this fall. That could be a real challenge for somebody. So, you know, you could provide them another 6-8 weeks of preparation. So it could be a really, really big step if we get a chance to play it.
Yeah. And somebody's cuckoo clock, by the way, according to my computer, is 2 minutes early. So you may want to check your setting on that. What's the word coming out of the pro camp? What did your son hear coming out of DC United, Matt?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating. You know, one, I think that, you know, and again, is one of the things I really have to say, just as a parent, just the MLS's response to it with their pro players, and then the way it trickled down to their academies was really pretty awesome. And, you know, they immediately, as it kind of started to figure out what this was, they suspended training, and they had taken some steps for social distancing and had kids bring in their own water bottle and had some rules and even changed some of the activities to where it was more of a technical based session. So that was, as a parent, that was pretty sharp. But then as it became apparent, what was going to happen, you know, so my son is obviously lives in DC and trains with their group. You know, now he's back in North Carolina. And, you know, at first it was 2 weeks and then it kind of expanded. And then as it goes forward, right, who even knows if they're going to finish out that season. And that's, it's going to be really challenging, because there's a whole nother level to that too, is because especially in the development academy, but in particular in the MLS academies where these kids are hoping to be pros. Well, now you're pressing pause on that those individual development programs. And now you're also pressing pause on the evaluation of those programs. And it's just going to create such a backlog. And I think one of the things that, yeah, I mentioned it before, there are kids that may have been fast tracked to where everyone they included thought they were going to be pros. This may disrupt the way things work in the business side of things to where there's a whole nother player pool available at the college. And again, that just, and the hard part is for the players from places that are off the beaten path or are coming from places that don't have a lot of eyeballs on them in terms of soccer professionals. That could get challenging, because then there's a whole lot of low hanging fruit for, especially for these programs and these top programs that are going to be in the mix for. So I think that, you know, again, not to toot our own horn here, but I mean, it literally is going to be about advocacy. But I, you know, the pro side of it, I mean, you know, from the first team, all the DC United guys are out and they are self-quarantined. And then that trickles down to the USL group at Loudoun and they're on quarantine. And then that trickles down to the academy players. And, you know, it's been fascinating to watch the emails that these guys are trying to get back to, you know, to keep these players engaged. But when you look at between a 19s, a 17s, a 15s, and a 14s, and a USL team and a pro team, you're talking, you know, a couple hundred players that are now have no interaction with the staff or with each other other than over the internet. And it's really challenging. And, but it, you know, obviously soccer pales in comparison to what's going on in our country and our world with this virus, but it's hard to be able to explain to my 16-year-old that was just living the dream of being able to train alongside pro players. So like, hey, listen, I don't know when you're going to get to go back, and we don't know what it's going to look like when you get to. So that's, again, it's just all like we talked about the game. This thing is so new to everyone. It's up in the air, and it's going to come back to how nimble they are. And so, and like I told him, I'm like, well, take advantage and get outside as much as you can and get your work in. So that way, when it goes back, you're ready to continue to put good stuff on tape so you can move your career forward. But that's hard, right?
Yeah, it is hard. And it's funny, I'm watching the internet blow up on walls, right? People talking about wall work. Hey, get out there. It's just you and a wall, so you're not going to get anybody sick. So go ahead and get some workout. And we've been trying to chip in by giving away our free wall workout. And we've been just trying to help people stay calm, because this could be 30 days, it could be 60 days, it could be 90 days. We really don't know, do we?
No.
I think this just goes back to why I'm so in favor of, you know, the student athlete route over, you know, going straight into the professional game. Obviously, if you've got the opportunity, a lot of players are going to go down that route. But in terms of gaining your education, I mean, who's to say, you know, something like this won't happen again in 5 years or 6 years, you know, so on. When it's your son going through college or something like that. So this can disrupt guys like Matt was saying, you know, that have been fast-tracked and, you know, believed that they were going to go professional, you know, for years now. And we're aiming towards that way of, so some of these guys might not make it as a cause of this, you know, with the backlog that we're talking about, it might mean less opportunities available. So having your education behind you is vitally important. I know a lot of the schools have closed down, but a lot of them are moving towards you know, digital learning and online learning, which, you know, will eventually be the future of how things are done. But just on the program, yeah, like you can't plan for this stuff. You've got to react to it. And like you guys are saying, the difference will be shown when we do get back to playing soccer. The guys that have been putting in the work at home and by themselves, keeping themselves fit, healthy, you know, nutrition's another big part that we haven't mentioned. And yeah, the difference will be there for all to see. Would you agree, Don, or?
Yeah, I think so. I think that sounds fair. Yeah, that sounds about right. Does anybody else have a contrary take to it?
No.
Matt? No, I mean, success favors the prepared.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that we talk about, obviously, you know, the vote was supposed to happen in April to go to that 10-month season. I think that a really negative part of this, and, you know, and Ernie and Mike, you've been in the NCAA a long time, I think you're going to agree with me. The NCAA, and in particular athletic administrators, are going to look at this, and you look through what the nightmare was of, especially for spring sports, you know, completed 10, 12, 15 games in baseball, for example. Those kids are all getting a year of eligibility back. If soccer went to a 10-month model, you could really argue, especially that, well, with half the season left, now you're talking about a whole nother group of, you know, this is one of those things where financially, this ever happening again and this type of shelter in place, social distancing, canceling group events like this, if soccer was on a 10-month season, not only would it be potentially challenging, but for the schools that aren't the Power Fives, this could be completely financially disruptive in that you'd almost be having to turn to players and say, listen, I'm going to give you a year of eligibility, but I don't have the money for you because I just don't, we can't afford it. And that, to me, I look at that, and that's the part that maybe disappoints me the most is I look at this and I understand the fiscal responsibility. I do understand that, but you know, for me, it's like, can college soccer just catch a break here? You know, and this is, I feel awful for the softball and the baseball student athletes in the track and field, and you know, and also for the swimmers who are going to try and compete for a national title. But it, and I look at the way it's going to affect, you know, soccer. It's like this could be a real problem. You know, now I think maybe the opportunity is like for the NPSL. NPSL might become a true development opportunity where all of a sudden it's all filled with youth and eligible players, where literally the NPSL and USL League 2 might very well just be a great example of, okay, let's see what these kids can do in preparation for college in the next level. And maybe that would be awesome, but yeah, it's going to start to think about all the ways that this simple, this coronavirus has started to affect not only everything, but just the landscape of just our sport in general. It's mind-boggling.
Well, two things came to mind while you were talking there, Matt. One is, what about a track athlete? What about a distance runner who runs cross country in the fall, indoor track in the winter, and spring track distance in the outdoor season in the spring? Do they get a year of eligibility back? And if they do, are they able to then run cross country in the fall, which they've already done, indoor track in the winter, which they've already done? Or do they have to stay silent on those two and they're being paid to go to school for 6 months when they're doing nothing to represent the school? So your question of the 10-month season, that brought to mind, okay, we have athletes like that right now. We have athletes who are full-year athletes that have basically competed in two-thirds of the academic year. And so I would be interested to see how that's going to be treated amongst the NCAA and NAIA's four-year programs. And then the second thing that came to mind when you were talking in particular about the NPSL and the USL2 situation, and this would be a question more to Mike, who's in that situation now at Fort Wayne, is there really any discussion, or could there be a real live discussion now to talk about communities having one of those two programs, NPSL or USL2, and almost treat it like a professional club team where kids are able to go to college, but yet not play for the college and just play year round with this professional club team outside the college realm for the kids who could afford it. I mean, you could open up another avenue where, yes, there's a 10-month development program. We have it. It's, you know, maybe the seasons change for those pro clubs or the, you know, semi-amateurs, whatever you want to call them, where they're getting, I think BYU tried it a few years ago, where their club team was an actual USL2 team, but almost professionalizing, you know, college soccer to the level where kids, the only thing negative to that is the only money they get are academic monies. And then the club, the pro team would almost have to find a way, although they could at this point probably, you know, necessary expenses, pay enough to make it worthwhile for a kid to live somewhere. Maybe he pays 10 grand to go to school because he's a smart kid. That's an interesting concept to even think about at this point.
Yeah. The track thing is fascinating. The track thing, the way those kids look is they play three different sports. So they literally but that's the way the NCAA looks at it. So if you run, say your freshman year, you redshirt in cross country, but then it is literally three different sports, and running cross country doesn't affect your track eligibility. So, and that's the hard part, is because, you know, and then it's up to the school, like, hey, listen, I can fund you so you can run track. Or it's like, hey, you know what? You're graduated out of money. Take your year of track eligibility. Is there somebody that can use it?
Yeah, there
and,
you go.
And again, but the soccer part, man, it's like, I look at this, we were on a 10-month schedule. You could argue, just based on the model, you haven't started the second half of the season. So say then you give all those kids an extra year, and I mean, it's mind-boggling, because the transfer portal for NCAA soccer is already 1,000-plus deep. It would go nuts, because there would be places like, hey, listen, you're player number 18 on the roster. See ya. And that's like, now, maybe the ancillary benefit would be there could be a ton of movement coming down, like Division I players going to find spots in D2 and AIA D3. But, man, that – this whole thing is just, it's just really, really challenging. And again, it all comes back to the same thing. It's like, it comes back to the coaches and the student athletes that are prepared and organized. That's going to give them the best chance to be nimble and thus be successful. And that's, in reality, if you don't know the answers, go find someone that help you can be prepared and organized.
Yeah.
Yep. I agree 100%.
I would be very, very hard pressed to believe that whenever we get it going again, hopefully it's sooner rather than later, that it's going to look the same way that it looks before this all happened. Something's going to change. And so, you know, I don't know what that is. I don't, you know, but something is going to change in this whole process. And again, I think these kids, these coaches, everybody involved have to be ready for that, because something is going to change.
Well, guys, have you guys had any, you guys got a quick synopsis. You don't have to name this. We probably don't name the school and the coach, but you can name the level. And I'll give you my first example of stories that we are being told. So we had one of our players, it happens to be an overseas player, being recruited by a Division I school. The coach said, I'm pretty sure I got more money for him. We can meet the family budget. We can make this work. Came back about 4 days later and said, well, now because we have spring athletes, you know, beach volleyball and baseball and softball, et cetera, getting extra time, we got no money. They're not going to give me any money. So there's one that I know for sure affected them. Since you guys have been talking to other college coaches and getting our players placed, have you heard any stories about how this is going to affect? What are coaches saying is what I'm asking.
I've had contact with a couple coaches who have said that incoming players have made different decisions with their families about even coming to their schools now. So not only is it affecting potentially kids who are on rosters wanting more money, or even recruits maybe asking for more money, I think it's affecting, you know, decisions of kids who have committed without signing potentially, who don't want to be as far away from their family, who may not want to pay as much money now to go to a school, I think you're going to see some transitioning and decisions potentially that could affect all of what we're talking about as well.
Wow. Hadn't quite that. Well, actually, now that you say that, I did have my first client that I've got that they kind of made that decision, and I hadn't really connected at all nationally. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, one of the guys that I talked to yesterday, he just shot me an email or text, whatever it was, and said, you know, hey, I've got a couple kids who have decommitted. I'm not really going to know the full effect until probably mid-April when all this starts to settle down a little bit more. He's like, so let me know what you have, what you're, you know, what's available. I had another guy write me last night who basically said a similar thing. You know, he hasn't been able to get the type of kids in touch with himself that he's had in the past because of some of this. He's not able, he's in a smaller school out in the Rocky Mountain area. So he can't get kids in to visit and all the things that we've talked about. And so I think, you know, this is affecting a lot of things in a lot of different areas that maybe we haven't thought of before, whether it's the kid and the family's ability to make decisions or pay for things, whether it's a coach's decision to use different avenues they maybe haven't done before because of the in-person and evaluative restrictions. Or the decisions universities are making at an administrative level to fund. So, I mean, it really is affecting a lot of different things. And I continue to go back to the same as the others have gone back to, those who have the information, those who are prepared, those who have the contacts to help in get them moving as quickly as possible, they're the ones, coaches, recruits, families, and even in some cases, universities, that are going to move forward the quickest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here's a message that just came through to me about an hour ago. I just checked in with a coach. If I told you who he was, you'd go, wow. I mean, he's very well connected on the women's side, very highly connected. Said, thanks. It's crazy times here. Everything has come to a screeching halt. And this is, you know, this is a very large program in the country, D1 program, and his the way he feels is everything has come to a screeching halt. And I've kind of noticed that even on social media, and those of you that know me know that I'm pretty active in social media, and I've noticed it's gone eerily quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Eerily quiet.
Well, this
you talk about.
Sorry, go ahead, Matt.
Go ahead, James. Well, I was going to say, like, the part we're talking about for player evaluation, but then the hardest part, and this is maybe some for the 20s, but especially for the 21s on both sides, both the men's and the women's game, is that kids can't go to campus. So we talk about the right fit playing wise, but remember, this is where they're going to school. And obviously, it's going to be about football to some respect, but it's going to be about how do I feel? Do I feel safe? Do I feel comfortable? Do I feel like this is a great place for me to develop, not only on the pitch, but then offwards? It's going to be so hard to really make decisions, especially in soccer being not an equivalency sport, not a counter sport, where, you know, invariably there's going to be some type of financial contribution on the student athlete's part. You're not going to be able to, for lack of a bad metaphor, you're not going to be able to go kick the tires. You're not going to be able to kind of see how this is going to fit. And that's going to be, we talk about the decision process. That's really going to slow this down. And that's, you know, again, that to me, I'm looking at like, wow, kids, like, coach, I really like your school, but I kind of got to go see how it feels when I eat in the cafeteria, or what it's going to look like when I go to the student union, or what does the chemistry lab look like? And how do I feel about the library as a great place for me to study? Because until I go and smell the air and see the bits, I can't make that decision. That's tough, because it could be like, yeah, it's a great scholarship offer. And yeah, I really like your program, but, you know, coach, I'm also trying to go to school. So I need to go see where it's going to be. And also too, we've all have, you know, I'm a parent. I wouldn't have sent my kid to go play at an MLS academy without going and sitting down and talking with the coaching staff and seeing the training facility and hearing the philosophy, meeting with the trainers, talking about what the insurance is for potential injuries, you know, what the rehab protocols are going to be to have them return to play. And like, and then you add the fact of, especially international players who may or may not have the means, but even if a school wanted to bring them over, they can't come here and see what it's all about. That's tough.
I think just touching on that, I think we mentioned earlier from a college coach's point of view, you guys are looking to guys, you know, that you trust to recommend players and such. The same works as an international player, obviously having done it myself. I think having people you trust in and around you that can give you, you know, sound, solid advice, whether it's, you know, us guys that are, you know, guiding clients through this stage, or whether it's, you know, a guy that's in the program there reaching out to, you know, players on the team rather than speaking to the coaches. I think from our point of view, I think that's the best advice you can get, or the best we can do in them circumstances. Similar to what, you know, coaches are doing in terms of the recruiting, where they're reaching out and just getting as much information as possible. I think that's all you can do at this time, is give yourself as much information as possible. But Matt, just touching on what we just said there, from a coach's perspective again, is it very much hands to the deck for coaches at this point, or is it a kind of, you know, we wait to see what happens, what unfolds with this? As you guys said, you know, there's a lot of unknowns that we don't know at the moment. So is it a case of all hands to the deck, or is it a case of wait a few, you know, more days, a week or so to see what happens or unfolds?
Well, I think the fascinating thing, you know, Mike talked about the team that's already there, and this is, I'm going to kind of generalize, but this is the majority of what's happening right now on college campuses. Kids went on spring break. Some, then they were told, okay, you're going to have your spring break extended. We'll see you at this date. Now what's happening is, like, come back to school, grab all your things, and then go home, and then we'll tell you when you can come back for next year. And when you think about just the stress of what I just said, then put yourself in an 18 to 22 year old situation, and then potentially do it where you're talking about traveling over long distances, the sheer expense for some families. And then imagine if you are coming someplace where you've been very fortunate enough to get a very high academic package or a high athletic package, or you're on a full scholarship because that's really the only way you are going to be able to attend that institution. Having the resources to be able to go back and forth maybe three times in the last week, I don't care how well off a student athlete's family is, that is hard. And then when you add in the travel restrictions that you're starting to see with both airfare, and so now you're talking about, can kids even get home the first part? And that's, so when you talk about hands all on deck, absolutely. You coaches are now becoming RAs. And you know, helping kids move out of the dorms. Coaches' garages are literally like, listen, okay, bring your stuff to the garage. Basically, it'll be a storage unit until you get back here, because obviously you don't have the ability to rent a truck, or, you know, you've got to jump in with this carpool and get home, and there's only room for a suitcase. And then trying to manage the academic piece. So literally, I think college coaches now are starting to find themselves full-on academic advisors, full-on tutors, full-on travel coordinators, and then at the same time, just trying to triage the nightmare of information that is being asked of by parents and everyone else. I mean, so all hands on deck, absolutely. It's, you know, talking to, you know, in town here, the local Division I school, talking to the basketball coach and the baseball coach, the baseball coach is like, I'm having to do all this stuff, and at the same time, putting my arms around guys and saying, I'm so sorry that your career ended like this, you know, because the kids that, you know, there's kids, he's got, you know, there's baseball players who, you know, they'd love to use for another year of eligibility. They're like, hey, you know what, man, I've already committed to take this job starting July 1. And I'm going to graduate and I'm going to move on. You know, so you've worked 17, 18 years to play your senior year and ride off into the sunset. And man, so yeah, for coaches, all hands on deck. The skill sets that are being required are some that I think that these men and women didn't even know they had. And then now it's like, oh, none of it's awesome.
No.
Boy, that really puts it into perspective. It really does, because I see through social media high school parents complaining that it's not fair that the senior, you know, that they're child coming in may not have the same opportunity because a senior had their season extended. But the fact is, a lot of kids won't even have that opportunity, will they? I think your point is very well taken, Matt, that they've been looking for jobs. They've got jobs to go on to, and they're going to be going on with their lives. And yeah, a lot of kids, it really is sad when we know how hard these kids work their whole lives to be able to, you know, walk off that senior year in with their heads held high and being playing games, you know, not walking away. They've had to walk away. It's crazy.
No, so guys, just to wind it down and kind of summarize, what can players be doing now? Like we said, it's tough on everybody, this, but it sounds to me a lot like the most important thing is just surround yourself with people you trust, you know, get the information off those people, get as much information as possible and collate it, and kind of just see how it all unfolds. Ernie, have you got any sort of closing comments that you want to just add? Or
no, I think we've hit on a lot of important points. I think, you know, the biggest one that keeps being brought up is having as much available information as possible to be able to make as quality a decision as quickly as possible. For me, that means having people you trust on both sides of the conversation, whether it's a family, a coach, an advisor, a service, whatever it is you've got on the recruiting side, as well as then people who are connected to the college side and their connections with coaches, people they trust, you know, because I think it's a decision for a lot of people that's going to come down to making it quickly, and without maybe as much information as these decisions have been made with in the past, whether it's campus visits, whether it's time with the team, whether it's seeing the team play, all the things that we advise these kids to try to do as much as possible. You know, the kids that waited too long to do that are now going to have to make some decisions without that information. So having those people around you that are knowledgeable, that have the relationships to give you the information you need and put you in a position to make the best decision possible for you and your family as quickly as possible in this time is going to be the most important.
Absolutely. Mike, do you want to add anything?
No, I think, I mean, everybody's done such a good job at kind of wrapping the thing up. I think it's been nice for an hour not to look at the news. And so I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about something else and think about something else. And, you know, the silver lining, I think, in all of this is it's a reminder to us all that we're fortunate. We're talking about playing sports and going to college. And, you know, these are great times in their lives. And we're fortunate that we get a chance to experience them. And really what's most important is that we're healthy and we're our family's healthy and safe. And, you know, so if we do hit the pause button for a little bit and we catch our breath and remind ourselves what's really important, this will value these opportunities even more, I think. And so I think it's a good thing in that regard.
No, absolutely. Matt, any final comments that you want to add? Or?
Well, I mean, I'm going to echo what Mike said. It's been lovely to not think about any of this stuff and to kind of talk about the future. And even though we're talking about speculation, but at the end of the day, we're talking about something that's very positive. And I just, you know, and again, this is, you know, we haven't seen anything like this in terms of a global scale in a long time, fortunately, in terms of where people are facing hardships. And, you know, I think Mike's exactly right. It kind of reminds you what's important. And I would imagine, you know, and my son left me with a really good comment this morning as he was going downstairs to do some school. He's like, you know what, if nothing else, I'm so excited to be able to get back into the environment. And I was like, even the fitness. And he's like, I would pay thousands of dollars, Dad, if I could go be doing a fitness test right now in DC. And I was like, and that to me was really, I was like, that's awesome, because he's realizing what a gift he has to be able to do what he's doing and to play this game. And I was like, all right, fantastic. So there's a silver lining. It's like, it's just going to reinforce how wonderful this game really is. So. But I'm ready for this to be over. Like, I'm ready. Let's get back to normal. That'd be great.
Thank you guys again for coming on and for doing this. And I think this is going to be valuable information that people are going to want to hear about what we see going on out there.
Absolutely. And what I will add to this, just to finish, is anybody that's listening, you know, we're trying our best to keep up to date with everything we're talking about, you know, the need to keep up with everything and gather as much information as possible. If anybody does have any questions, wants any advice, you know, these are the guys that you need to talk to. So send us a message after this, and we'll do our best to get back to you, you know, any separate questions. Yeah, we're here to help. You know, it's a troubling time, so we've all got to, you know, dig in and stick together. So, yeah, just thought I'd finish on that. Well,
James, we'll stick this number in our contact information, but, you know, you can always email us at info@sportsrecruitingusa.com. You can also get a hold of us by texting us at 650-297-0655. Again, that information will also be in the notes, in the show notes. So, yeah, any questions anybody has, as James said, we're staying on top of this whole situation as closely as possible.
So, yeah, guys, just want to say thank you ever so much for your time again. It's been an absolute pleasure. Yeah, thanks a lot.